Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Axis Mundi.
Welcome to One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew L. Seidel, a constitutional attorney and the author of The Founding Myth and American Crusade. This is a podcast about religion, the law, and the battle for America's soul. We'll be separating church and state, defending freedom and equality, and fighting Christian nationalism. If you haven't already, sign up for our weekly bonus content and ad-free listening at accessmundi.us. LFG, folks.
There's nothing better than a book that makes you rethink everything. Everything you thought you knew is suddenly seen in a new light because those doors in your mind have been opened by this book. And I actually have a list of these books that I maintain. I put it up on bookshop.org, and it's called Books That Make You Rethink Everything. It includes Caste by Isabel Wilkerson, The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, The Demon-Haunted World by Andrian and Carl Sagan, Invisible Women by Caroline Criado Perez is one that I just read that I cannot stop thinking about, Between the World and Me, Ta-Nehisi Coates. And today, I'll be speaking with the author of one of the books that appears on this list, Kate Cohen, who wrote We of Little Faith, Why I Stopped Pretending to Believe, and Maybe You Should Too. Now, I added We of Little Faith to that list, to the list of books that make you rethink everything, because, well, I'm just going to read the blurb, or part of the blurb that I wrote for Kate's book. Cohen's witty, compassionate take on America's religious culture is atheism as it should be, as it truly is, fulfilled, happy, and true to oneself. This is the quotidian atheism your friends and family may be too timid to discuss, but which Cohen illuminates with absorbing eloquence. If you think about religion, you owe it to yourself to read this book. And I will just also add that for that reason, Kate's book makes a really wonderful gift to those religious friends and family members that maybe have a hard time understanding your atheism, dear listener. She does a really beautiful job of explaining where we are coming from. So Kate Cohen, my friend, welcome to One Nation Indivisible.
Thank you for having me. And also, can we just stop right there? Because that was amazing. And I think we'll leave a better impression of me than I might myself. So I appreciate it. I really do.
Oh, no.
How are you doing?
I'm trying to stay sane, hang in there.
I
love being able to hang out and talk with you about these times that we are in. Mm-hmm. I really want to get into like the main reason. You and I have been texting a little bit lately because you kind of had a big change, and I want to set that stage for our listeners here, because I think a lot of people know who Jeff Bezos is. He's the Amazon billionaire. He's the guy who has so much money that he has started flying these phalluses to space. They just really look like that. He bought the Washington Post, the newspaper, in, I believe it was 2013, for $250 million. And you know, the Washington Post is this amazing paper. It's got this hallowed tradition of resisting and exposing the accumulation of power. And under Trump 1.0, Washington Post told us that democracy dies in darkness. And I believe that's when you started writing for WAPO. Is that right?
I started writing for them in, I guess, 2019. And I was actually under contract by 2020. But yeah. I will say that I think the reason that, well, one of the reasons I was really excited to work for them was the work that they did leading up to Trump's election and after Trump's election. I mean, I felt like they were far ahead of the New York Times in terms of not succumbing to the sort of both sides, the sort of both sides reporting.
Yeah, that prizing of balance over truth. They didn't seem to fall into that trap
exactly.
as much.
They didn't do it as much. And, you know, and they were ahead of the times in calling lies lies, which mm-hmm. I really appreciated. And so even though I live in New York, I live in Albany, and this is the New York Times is the local big paper here, of course, as it is for the nation, but even more here. Yeah, we were loyal subscribers. And so I was very excited to and I grew up in Virginia. So that was my hometown big paper, you know, when I was a kid. So I was so pleased and proud to be working there and to have that platform.
And
it was
so.
Because of Bezos, because he sort of decided to put a lot of money into opinion and mm-hmm. grow those pages and add people from around the country, apparently. So, you know.
Well, and now we're
so
in Trump 2.0.
Time.
Yeah. And now we've seen Bezos has donated a bunch of money to Trump's inaugural mm-hmm. fund and things like that. And in Trump 2.0, Bezos tells us that the opinion pages of the Post now are only for pieces that uphold, quote, the pillars of individual liberties and free markets. And so over the past few months, we've gotten kind of this drip, drip, drip of people who are leaving. So you have Anne Telnace. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how you say her name. She was this, I actually mm-hmm. pushed out her. She's a Pulitzer Prize winning cartoonist. And she came up with this great cartoon of Bezos and these other billionaires begging mm-hmm. before Trump. And the cartoon was killed. So she left. Ruth Marcus, who was, in my mind, one of the only other writers who covered religion and especially church-state cases well, not quite as well as you. She left last month because the Post refused to run a column that she wrote dissenting from Bezos's sort of edict there. And then on Blue Sky, just the other day, you wrote, I'm grateful for all the people I worked with at the paper and all the columnists I got to write, all the columns I got to write as a feminist, a progressive, and an atheist. And I am sad at the recent confirmation that the paper's editorial independence is provisional and subject to the whim of its owner. And you left.
Yep. I left.
So why did you leave the Washington Post? Why is the big question that we always answer on this podcast, Kate?
I left, and, you know, I, of course, as you might imagine, thought a lot about what I wanted to say in that tiny little, you know, 300 character by 300 character mm-hmm. announcement. And I said confirmation very, very intentionally, because of course we were subject to his whims. It's just that the whims thus far hadn't reveal themselves to be so, I don't know, anti-journalistic, I guess. And I definitely had an immediate, when he made his proclamation, well, of course, back in November, was it November? No, it was late October when he pulled the Post's endorsement mm-hmm. of Harris.
Yeah, so just so listeners remember, the Post endorsed Harris and then yanked it. I think it was 5 or 6 days later, and they said, "Just kidding."
No, they had written an endorsement. The editorial mm-hmm. board had the endorsement ready, but they hadn't published it. And Bezos said they couldn't.
Can't publish
it. And then can't publish it. and we don't make endorsements anymore. This was 11 days before the election. And at that point, the Post lost a ton of subscribers, and it lost some of its editors and some of its writers. But I, you know, I did not feel that. I think a lot of us felt like we were still doing the work that we thought we should be doing, and that our work was important. And I, you know, I still feel like that. And there's still great people at the Post, and they're still doing great work. But we are in this little limbo period right now. He made that pronouncement at the end of February. The head of opinions resigned. You know, no leftist he, but that was too far. And now they're looking for his replacement. And the people who are there now running things are not putting in, or have not yet implemented this new vision. Ruth Marcus tested the theory with a very specific pointed kind of criticism of the paper itself and of Bezos's decision, and that they wouldn't run that. And then she left. But in terms of, you know, the things that I think there's still a lot of good progressive work happening at the Post. But I will tell you that morale is super low, and that a lot of people are waiting for the next shoe to drop. And I didn't want to wait for it. And I also couldn't really afford to, because, and here's where, you know, capitalism is like the most salient question.
It has us captured.
Everything. It has us captured. I was not on salary. I was a contract worker. So what I had was the promise that I could write whatever I want, which is amazing. The prestige of writing for one of the world's great newspapers. And a bar on writing for other outlets. And essentially, Bezos threatened the first two, right? Yep. You're not going to be able to write whatever you want. And the prestige of this paper is, I am personally going to crater the prestige of the Washington Post, basically, is what he said. And because I wouldn't get unemployment, I wouldn't get, you know, severance. There's no protections if you're a contract worker. I just thought, I'm going to leave now and make my way in the world. But it does come, you know, it was a great platform. And I, of course, second guess myself in this moment. But I have to remember how easy it is, and I think this is important for all of us right now, how easy it is to adjust to things, to adapt to things. I'm a very nice, easygoing person. And I was a little bit afraid if I stayed, then I would accept I could write about everything except these three things, or I could write about anything I wanted to about the Oscar nominees, or I could write, you know, which I love to do those things, and there's plenty to write about, but I was afraid of my own tendency to, I don't know, get along, capitulate. So I thought, I'll cut it off, and I'll just go. But
it's the natural human tendency too, right? I mean, the natural human tendency is to get along with the people you have to spend your time with, and you have to, that you're relying on for that income. And, you know, I'll just read a bit for folks from what Ruth Marcus said, because there's one line in here that I think kind of gets it. She said, you know, she wrote this column respectfully dissenting from Bezos's edict. Something I had not experienced in almost two decades of column writing was that they refused to run that dissent, and she had not experienced that in almost two decades of column writing. So that limbo that you're talking about being in was not just, it wasn't just this kind of hypothetical, we're not sure which way it's going to go. People were already experiencing this. And that's,
for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, and that it's that, yeah. I mean, we all know that the frog doesn't actually slowly boil, but it does. It gets to that people really can, you know, the little gradual changes help get us accustomed to this.
Yeah.
you know, you...
It's better as a metaphor than as a real thing.
Yes.
That's why that frog thing keeps going, even though people do... Frogs jump out. You are absolutely right.
I actually dove down the rabbit trail of that.
I know.
One time, and like it actually comes from a scientific experiment where they removed parts of the frogs' brains, and like those frogs stayed in, but the frogs with the whole brains didn't. Anyway, it's a whole thing. But
oh wow, we could really get into that metaphor.
Yeah, it was a real rabbit trail.
Interesting. Interesting. That probably pertains.
It may be more analogous than we first thought.
Maybe. Yes. Exactly.
So, you know, I mean, one of the you mentioned kind of balancing, sort of, you know, these kind of three interests that you flagged, and one of the things that sort of struck me were, I mean, first I was struck by, like, I thought this was a very brave decision and courageous, and I immediately admire it, and then I'm also at the same time sad because, you know, despite the claims that we hear from the Christian nationalist politicians and preachers, right, there are actually very, very few openly godless voices in our media, and there is just this inherent baked in favoritism and respect and deference for religion. So
yes.
I mean, how did you kind of balance that you are one of these few openly atheist godless voices in one of the only powerful outlets against your principle? I mean, it seems to me there's an agreement in a way.
This is why these moral decisions are so difficult. I mean, I definitely they won't have the columns that I would have written in the next few months or something, and those columns won't reach whoever they would have reached. And I don't know, but you know, at a certain point, everybody makes their decision at a certain point. And I felt like I don't want to feel... A lot of my writing is about self-censorship, I feel like. So We of Little Faith is a lot about how, despite the fact that I had a very nice family and a very liberal, you know, Reformed Jewish upbringing, and everybody around me was, you know, basically Mormon loving, I still wouldn't admit to not believing. And of course, so much of that comes from what the culture taught me was how I was supposed to behave, and what a good person was, which is someone who believed in God. But you know, you have to let your culture do that to you to a certain extent, especially once you get to be an adult, you know. Mm-hmm. And I let that happen, and I chose not to say things that I you know, I wish I had been more outspoken about. So so I guess I, in leaving the Post, I I kind of cut off my own opportunity for self-censorship in this funny way. I mean, I assume at some point I would have been censored actually by the powers that be, but I didn't want to get myself in a position where I was like, well, maybe I'll pitch this one instead of this one, because I want this one to get in, and So I think that's part of it. So that's one way in which that they're connected. But, you know, I am proud of the things that I wrote in there that were very clearly, matter-of-factly, from an atheist perspective, some about being an atheist, but some not. Just, you know, I feel like I somewhat, not stealthily maybe, but casually, you know, while making other arguments, made it clear that the religious way of looking at things wasn't the only way of looking at things. And so, yeah, I'm proud of that stuff. And I hope to, you know, I hope this is just a hiatus and the New York Times will quickly scoop me up. We'll be at it again. Yeah.
I love that idea.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
So, I mean,
I think it's good.
Well, you no longer have a massive platform. And mm-hmm. I mean, Washington Post comes close to One Nation Indivisible's circulation.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it's quite there yet, but, you know, it's got a little ways. But, I mean, is there anything you wish that you could say, you know, that you have been self-censoring since you left, that you've been careful about, but now you feel the need to get out there? Because now would be a wonderful time to do it.
Okay, well, there are pieces that I'm working on right now. Mm-hmm. And of course, the moment I quit, I had about 20 columns I wanted to write.
yeah.
Of course. So, you know, I am really, really interested in the incursion of religion into public life, as you know, and into education,
yes,
in particular. And I am working on a couple of different pieces about that from the perspective not necessarily about the separation of church and state, but about the separation of truth and falsehood, fact and fiction. And I believe that this is a really urgent question.
Yes.
That just sort of by definition, a person of faith, a believer, is someone who is, you know, willing to operate without evidence, someone who's willing to accept that things are true without having any kind of verifiable proof or, you know, even sort of perceived reality. Mm-hmm. And there have been studies, of course, about the susceptibility of religious people to conspiracy theories. I think we can see that they are more susceptible to Republican lies, misinformation. And so I think that this new front that I'm really, really interested in is the way in which the religious right has been trying to bring religion into the schools, mm-hmm. And the way that undermines the whole concept of you know, factual truth.
Yeah.
So I'm having fun with the new curriculum standards for Texas. Mm-hmm. And really doing a deep dive. You can't bring the Bible into the classroom and treat it like it's history. You can't treat it like it's science. You know, you can't treat Queen Esther like she's a historical figure. She's not a historical figure. And that's what they're doing. So I'm having fun with that. But the underlying that sort of cultural critique is the sort of greater concern for for reality and for holding that line between fact and fiction. And I have to say, I love fiction. You know, I love fiction. I love yeah, art. I love me metaphors. Too. I love symbolism. I love I love that stuff.
But only when we appreciate it as that, not when we treat
only
it as...
when we appreciate it. Not, yes, exactly.
And for how it can shine a light so it's, on truth, not as truth.
Right. Not as truth. There's a difference. And I don't think you have to be, you know, super anti-religion to maintain that difference.
No.
And or to stress that difference or to value that difference. And so, you know, it's part of the whole attack on truth, on scientific truth, on, I mean, it's terrifying, right? The idea that you can just declare immigrants in the social security system dead, even though you know they're alive, but just as a way to attack them, you know. And of course, the like defunding of all our great institutions of research and higher learning. And
yeah,
I mean, it goes on and on. And of course, and going back to Donald Trump as the lyingest liar that has ever I mean, you can't even, I don't even want to finish that sentence because there's no comparing him to any other politician.
He's far and away the most mendacious politician that has ever occupied public office in this country.
Yep.
I mean, I'm glad to hear that you're focusing on that. I mean, it's one of the reasons actually that I agreed to begin this podcast in the first place. And it's something that I've really been struggling with on the legal side of things, because if we do not live in a shared reality, the rule of law becomes impossible. And I think that is one of the things that we are really struggling with as a country right now, and that the people who value things like liberty and justice and truth and due process and basic human rights are running up against with a lot of the shit that Trump is pulling, because the other side of this does not live in the reality that we do. They do not share reality with us. In their world, these people who have not gone through due process, so by definition cannot be guilty of anything, cannot be criminals, because you cannot be those things until you have had due process. They are criminals, they are gang members, and that's why they should be disappeared and put in a what is effectively a concentration camp, right? I mean, that they are political prisoners, so this really ought to be, I think, called a concentration camp. You know, you mentioned, it is a very, very difficult thing to deal with, and we are seeing it certainly bleed into the courts. I mean, the Supreme Court is getting ready to hear a case on April 30th, which, of course, we'll cover on this pod, about whether or not we can have religious public schools. That's what the case amounts to.
I feel like you are, I'm sorry.
No, please.
But I feel like you are, like, you and, you know, all the amazing people who are bringing suit are really rightly focusing on this constitutional question. And I feel like I am so happy that you are. And I feel like, but there's also this other question of, like, you know, what is education, and can we even call it education if we are teaching things that are not truth? They're not factual truth. They could be important in some ways, but you cannot call it truth. And I just feel like it is such a toxin in that way,
and it does seem like the word for that, for teaching things that are not true, is indoctrination, or propaganda.
Interesting. Yeah.
I mean, we're certainly seeing that in, you know, you mentioned Texas. I think we're seeing that in Oklahoma too.
In Oklahoma,
I think the push that we are seeing to put the Ten Commandments up in the classrooms, right? They don't want the Ten Commandments up because they say don't kill. They want the Ten Commandments up in the classroom begin, I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me.
And they, you know, and I mean, insult to injury, they pretend it's because it's one of the foundational documents of the United States, which you must just love. The lying on top of the promotion of falsehoods, and it breaks one's brain.
Well, hang on. You mentioned that you thought you would be censored by the Post at some point. And I'm curious. So we're recording this just before Good Friday and Easter, but it's airing after Good Friday and Easter. And I sent you the text of Trump's Holy Week executive order. And, like, to me, like, maybe this would have been the moment, right? Like, maybe, because, I mean, did you get a chance to read it?
Oh, I read it at the time. Yes. It's insane. It's so over the top. Mm-hmm. I feel like it would be inappropriate in church. I just felt like, I feel like, okay.
Yeah, like even a pastor might be like, this is a little bit much.
Yeah, just a little. And, you know, again, insults to injury, or I don't know if this is better or worse, but you know he doesn't believe. You know, that's the other thing. It's just a complete fake. Wait, I found, because I was thinking about it, so I looked. Do you remember what he said last year on Easter?
Oh, no.
He put out this thing on Truth Social. I'm going to start reading it.
Yeah.
You can stop me anytime. It goes on. Happy Easter to all, including crooked and corrupt prosecutors and judges that are doing everything possible. Oh, wait, I forgot. All caps. Happy Easter to all, including crooked and corrupt prosecutors and judges that are doing everything possible to interfere with the presidential election of 2024 and put me in prison, including those many people that I completely and totally despise because they want to destroy America, a now failing nation, et cetera, Jack Smith.
Yeah. So, and let's just compare.
Happy Easter, everyone.
And let's compare that to I'll just read the first paragraph.
Just go ahead.
This Holy Week, Melania and I join in prayer with Christians celebrating the crucifixion and resurrection of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, the living Son who conquered death, freed us from sin, and unlocked the gates of heaven for all humanity. Beginning with Christ's triumphal entry into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday and culminating in the Paschal Triduum. Like, give me a break. There's zero chance he had any input on all of this. But the line that like really bothered me, like it was, I agree it was dripping and I agree it was like laying it on a little thick for even like a clergyman, was where he says, this Holy Week, my administration renews its promise to defend the Christian faith in our schools, military workplaces, hospitals, and halls of government. And that and that jumped out at me because that is just fundamentally out of bounds, right? Like next year we're going to celebrate the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. And I absolutely just hate that Trump is going to be president for that. And the Declaration is a condemnation of kings and would-be kings like Trump. And this idea that he is going to defend the Christian faith, like one of the titles that the king that we declared independence from had was defender of the faith. So when we're throwing off a king who has that title, and Trump is bestowing it effectively upon himself in this Holy Week proclamation, I found it just infuriating.
I mean, you know who Trump reminds me of? God. He reminds me of God. The biblical character. That's what I thought when I watched him in the Oval Office with Zelensky. Remember that insanely offensive moment? He's demanding that he be properly worshipped, basically, for everything that he's done for Ukraine. And it just was like the Book of Exodus. The Old Testament God who demands fealty. And he's not, I don't know. I was just at a Seder, so this is really on my mind. But I grew up thinking that Passover was a holiday that celebrates freedom from oppression. Mm-hmm. And it is not at all. I mean, maybe it is now, but if you read the Book of Exodus, it's not about freedom from oppression. It's about, our God has a bigger dick than their God. And he tells Moses to tell Pharaoh, let our people go, or let my people go. But that's not the whole phrase. Let my people go so they may worship me, is what it is. And, of course, I mean, the whole thing. Like, it's not that Pharaoh didn't want to. It's just that God continually hardened his heart so that he could basically have an excuse to bring plagues and show how powerful he is. And if we don't remember him every year at this time and sing his praises continually, he will do the same thing to us. I have it here. It's, if you listen carefully to the Lord your God and do what is right in his eyes, if you pay attention to his commands and keep all his decrees, I will not bring on you any of the diseases I brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you.
I think it's right. I think it's right on.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this is
very Trumpy.
And I think this is the reason that we saw so many evangelicals attracted to Trump in the first place, right? They had been taught to venerate that character for their entire
that
lives.
That He-Man.
Yeah. I
mean, yes, he, yes.
Trump is a thin-skinned authoritarian who craves love and punishes any slight, any disloyalty. And this is who they've been taught to worship. So, and we actually know there are studies that bear that out, that religious fundamentalism and a tendency to submit to authoritarianism are very highly correlated.
Absolutely.
I mean, Ann Coulter called Trump, before they had their spat and their split, Ann Coulter called Trump her emperor god. I don't remember, those a while ago now. You know, I mean, on that same kind of note, on that same line, especially with the totalitarian line, you know, the first episode of this podcast was, I asked one of our experts, are we Germany in the 1930s? And your first book, The Nepi Madonna Diaries, did I say that right?
Madonna, but close.
I need to work on my Italian.
But it, Nepi Modena.
So you tell the stories.
You never have to say that again.
I'm done. But you tell the stories of this Jewish family who suffered under Italian fascism. They went into hiding to survive the Nazi invasion. And I mean, so do you see parallels here now to that research, to that story that you told? Or are we all just being hysterical?
No. We're not being hysterical. It is absolutely the parallels are scary. They are multiple. They are multiplying. That story, you know, it's interesting. I've been thinking about the Nepi Modenas a lot because talk about, you know, the proverbial frog that didn't exist. So I'm related to this family, and that is how I was able to do the to do the research. They had the mother and the daughter were still alive when I was visiting them, and they had journals that the father and the son kept that they neatly typed up, but that had never been published. So I got to look at the racial laws and the invasion and they're going into hiding from the perspective of four different people, from these two journals and then from interviews with the mother and the daughter. And it was really fascinating, but I think the character that I found the most tragic was the dad, because he was a professor. He was a veteran. He was a member of the fascist party, which you kind of had to be if you were going to be, you know, on a university faculty by a certain point. And he didn't really believe that his country was going to betray him, even after the racial laws, because what they did was at first they were like, well, if you're a veteran or if you're a member of the fascist party, you know, you're exempt. It was a very, and so he, I think, was mollified to believe that he was different from, like, you know, recent immigrant Jews or something. You know, he sort of separating the good kind from the bad kind, and then also scapegoating, of course, reviled people, you know, and persuading a certain amount of people who otherwise would resist that there's, you know, something truly scary about immigrants, or I mean, at the time, Jews, but now we've got the same thing happening with immigrants. We've got the same thing happening with trans people. You've got people that I would think would be on the right side of things who are like, huh, yeah, maybe trans kids shouldn't be participating in sports. You know, I mean, they're doing an amazing job of distracting us, dividing us, and convincing us either, you know, to lay low or to just totally capitulate. You know, one thing that really I've been thinking about, I felt sick about Columbia's university's capitulation. Yes. Because I really see a strong parallel between institutions of higher learning and religious institutions. I feel that, and I haven't yet gotten a chance to write about this, but I really feel that that, you know, in the search, which I talk about some in my book, in the search for, you know, how we're going to replace these, the actual good things that we get from religion, sort of including like community and including scheduled occasions to think about things beyond ourselves, and all, you know, including ways to mark time and et cetera. I really feel that higher education, colleges and universities, from the smallest to the most, you know, elite and, you know, richest, had the opportunity to be the secular church, had the opportunity to provide, you know, a sort of a space away from regular life for contemplation, had special rules for the people who belong to its community that were like a higher kind of a spelled out and also sort of a higher moral, you know, a schema than we have necessarily, you know, they've sort of more than the law, you know, is how you have to behave when you're on campus. There are all these ways in which even the architecture, you know, even as a place where you can go and you it belongs to you, but it's not quite yours, but it makes you feel big inside. You know, there's a lot of ways in which higher education can and had, I think, become kind of our default secular authority. And so when Columbia capitulated to the extent that it did, I mean, you know, it really felt to me very similar to the way that the Catholic Church did during the war. The Catholic Church, you know, there are many, many stories of individual priests, nuns, congregants helping Jews. But as an institution, they totally failed to stand up against the Nazis and the fascists. And so that, I believe, is another parallel. Like, this is the moment for institutions to stand up. And I was very heartened by Harvard's.
As was I.
Well,
it's the other thing, like, about Columbia is, like, you are, as an institute of higher learning, like, you should understand that history. And you should understand that capitulation to authoritarianism
isn't gonna work.
Never, ever works. They just come back and ask for more, which is what is currently happening. You give away a little bit of independence in that capitulation, and they just keep coming back and keep coming back until you are now an arm of that regime. And that's it. There is no middle ground. It's just a question of where you are on that timeline. And for them not to understand that, I think was kind of a little bit mind blowing.
I'm sure a lot of them, you know, I mean, I know a lot of people in the faculty, a lot of them did understand
this,
you know, so I wouldn't want to be a university president, but I believe that if you are, this is your time, man, this is your time. And
lead the way.
So yeah, lead the way.
Thanks for listening to the free version of today's episode. To get the whole conversation unfiltered and unfettered, sign up at accessmundi.us. Costs less than that latte you bought on the way to work, and I am just as delicious. Signing up also gets you premium content from Straight White American Jesus and other Access Mundi shows. Try it. You can always change your mind, because life is too good to waste on bad ideas. This has been One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew Seidel. Until next time.
Think about how much time you spend at home. Does your home really make you feel great? If not, it's time to change it. Now picture yourself coming home, seeing beautiful new furniture from Jordan's. Eating out or a vacation, those things just come and go. But walking into your room and loving what you see, you'll enjoy that every day. Right now, come to Jordan's Furniture and get 15% off everything or get up to 60 months with no interest.
Call 1-866-245-4722 for financing details. Restrictions apply. Subject to credit approval.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.